Okay. Thanks, Rafael. Thanks for KITP for an amazing few weeks. This is part of the program from inflation to the hot big bang, but I would say it's mostly focusing on the inflation part, and I will also draw some connections to the other program that's going on there. Okay. So, I mean, I don't really need to sell inflation to this crowd, but, you know, just for posterity, inflation has been the leading paradigm for the very early universe. It has an amazing simplicity in solving the problems of the old Big Bang theory, and furthermore gives us a framework, a consistent framework of calculating fluctuations and then comparing with experiments of the CMB and Laskin structure. This is the latest Planck results, and we see that the multiple moments match fantastically well with predictions of inflation and the Lambda CDM model. So the predictions of inflation are generally model specific, right? But however, there are some general patterns that most inflationary models share. One is a nearly scaling invariant spectrum and largely Gaussian perturbations. Of course, you can break, for example, Gaussianity by adding more fields and more complicated dynamics, but this is sort of the vanilla single field inflation.
What are the black dots at LF15?
Oh, this is a person trying to push up the low L model.
Oh.
Some people don't like it. So what do we know is we know the spectral index is 5 sigma away from flat, so it's not. I mean, we actually need something more than just postulating a Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum. The running is small, and FNL is also small. Of course, here I write FNL less than order one. If it's local or squeezed, you know, the numbers change, but in general, it's very Gaussian. That's what we know. So this is again the vanilla inflationary model needs gravity, just Einstein gravity, one scalar field with one potential. The Klein-Gordon equation is straightforward by applying the Euler-Lagrange method to the action, and from this you can drop the spatial variations, and you can drop the acceleration, and what you end up with is the Slöjdahl equations of motion. Which are sort of characterized by epsilon and eta, right, the two Slöjdahl parameters. And once you know them, you know everything, right? Once you know epsilon and eta, you know essentially the numbers that go into this plot. You know the tensor-scalar ratio, and you know the spectral tilt. And of course, epsilon starts being problematic because V prime over V needs to be much smaller than one to get Slöjdahl inflation, but needs to be order one if you believe the Swan-Planck conjectures. So already at my third slide, you know, people might start complaining about, you know, the nonsensical arguments that I'm writing on the board. Okay, now again, let's go to the sky and see what we see. So this is the plethora of models. This is actually the previous Planck results. This is not the latest Planck results. This is one released before. But still, you have a bunch of models that are ruled out over here, right? All the convex models are pretty much dead. But all the concave models are okay with certain degrees of agreement with the data. Now, the latest Planck results are still fine, right? You can still, they haven't changed much. They have squeezed a bit the spectral tilt, right? So this n equals 50 dot of the alpha tractor starts being in slight conflict with Planck data. If you're interested about how reheating can help you distinguish those two dots, you should see my conference talk that I gave a few months ago. A few weeks ago at the conference here. Okay, now, there's this plethora of models up here that you can naively write down, phi squared, phi fourth, or whatever polynomial models. And there are these nice models down here, like the Sarabinsky model, which sit at a very particular place, dead center in the Planck regime. And this is also both of theoretical interest, because, you know, there are models you can create, but it's also of observational interest, because CMB stage 4 and Lightbird are exactly trying to probe this r equals 10 to the minus 3 region, right? So these green dots are very important, both experimentally and theoretically. Now, so how can you go from here to here, right? What do you need to do? Well, you need to invoke field space effects, right? You need to go beyond just writing down a polynomial. You need to actually do something to the kinetic term over here. So one way to do this is by postulating or introducing a non-minimal coupling to gravity. Again, this at first sight, this might not seem like a field space effect, but believe me, it is. So Higgs inflation is the sort of the poster boy for these models, where you just get a 5-fourth potential, which is the Higgs potential, which is a very steep potential. It's up here, right? It's a very convex potential. And you turn it into a concave potential by introducing this non-minimal coupling. And the predictions of the of Higgs inflation and all its cousins are exactly identical to the Sarabinsky model. N sub s is 1 minus 2 over n. N is the number of epochs before the end of inflation, where you cross, where the fluctuation crosses the horizon. So this is 1 minus 2 over 60, roughly. And r is 12 over n squared. Again, n is 60, so r is 10 to the minus 3. So 3 times 10 to the minus 3. N is 0.96, exactly where you want it. Another big family of models that exactly are sort of designed to live down here are the famous alpha attractors. So alpha attractors have seen a tremendous growth in the last 10 years or so, I would say, maybe a bit less. And the interesting thing with alpha attractors is that they draw their inspiration from string theory and supergravity. There are several computations of actually constructing specific alpha attractor models, and there are a few important characteristics. One is that most of these models are generically multi-field models, right? So, for example, the T model and the E model are not single-field models of inflation, even though sometimes we do write them as single-field for getting the second degree of freedom, but they are essentially multi-field models. And those fields live on a curved manifold, in particular a hyperbolic field space manifold. And again, hyperbolic field spaces are great because string theory sort of gives them to us for free. Right? You don't need to work hard to get them. They're just there. So they're a very interesting feature to start to study. Now, an interesting thing with alpha attractors on the observational side, at least the simple models that that I've written here, like the T and the E model, you can write the canonical normalized inflaton field as this sort of very exponentially flat potential. And there is one parameter alpha here. And the interesting thing is that while you get universal predictions for NS, which are exactly the same as Higgs inflation, R changes because you have this one parameter family of solutions, right? So it's 12 alpha over n squared. And alpha actually has physical meaning. It's not just a parameter. Alpha is related to the field space curvature of this field space. Small alpha, high curvature, right? This is, so essentially, as you go down this line, you go to more and more curved field space manifolds. And 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4 is where we sort of aim to go with our experiments. Okay, now we have these nice families of models. We again go to our string theory friends on the second floor, ask them what they think about scalar fields in the early universe, and they say there's going to be a lot, probably, right? It's, I mean, unlikely that string theory will only give you one scalar field. So how does this nice picture we have here change if we dump many scalar fields onto each model? So a very fantastic numerical work has been done by Richard Easter and collaborators on just taking m squared phi squared potential, taking multiple fields with m squared phi squared, adding them up and giving them random masses, and then running sort of Monte Carlo simulations and checking how the probability distribution of observables change. And in this very simple model, what happens is that as the number of fields goes up, the predictions shift to the left, right? So NS goes from 0.96 something to 0.95. Well, it's not terribly important because M squared phi squared is ruled out already, but it actually tells you that maybe if you put more fields into the simplest system you can write down, things happen, right? Interesting dynamics sort of emerges.
Does that depend on how you distribute randomly those masses?
Yeah, I mean there are all those things, but I think here they assume there's no strong hierarchy of masses. They're sort of uniformly distributed in a certain thing. So there's no, I mean, of course, if you put a strong hierarchy and some of them are very heavy, some of them are very light, then you will see something different.
That was my question.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Now, I gave you these two families of solutions. Where are they? These sort of Higgs-like inflation models and alpha attractors. So our idea was, okay, can we do the same for these field space, curved field space manifold models, these realistic models, right, that are not dead yet? So non-minimal couplings, the models that are based on these generalizations of Higgs inflation, are actually great when it comes to multiple fields because they don't care. So if you put two fields, right, so let's say a Higgs and something else, right, so two quartic fields with non-minimal couplings, then you do a conformal transformation to make gravity look nice, and you end up with this potential. You see that the potential is very flat, right, so you can inflate along this flat direction, but it has very steep valleys and ridges. So pretty much wherever you start, you will just roll down to one of these valleys and inflate along the valley. And we did a lot of sort of calculations with two fields and three fields, and unless you fine-tune both the potential and the initial conditions, so as long as you make these ridges very smooth and you start exponentially close to one of them, you will generically be indistinguishable from the Siegel field predictions. Now, we do want to do that for like 100 fields. We have not done it yet. But there's a code that can do that, and hopefully we'll do that soon. But at least for order a few fields, nothing changes. You have a fantastically strong single field attractor. Okay.
That single field attractor is not down what naively looked like the sort of.
It is.
Yeah, that's right. It's there. So it still has a Starobinsky type potential even.
Exactly.
Along the diagonal.
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean. Regardless, yeah, exactly. Wherever you inflate, I mean, this is just some potential. But if you inflate along some trajectory, then yes, there are Starobinsky-like predictions wherever you are. Of course, I mean, the only thing that I'm thinking here is that if you go to 100 fields, then maybe the different heights of the ridges and valleys will start being close together. So you might actually get some similar phenomenon like they did with the M2 phi squared model. So it's not 100% clear that 100 or 1,000 fields will still give you this kind of trivial Starobinsky results, but at least, 3, 4, 5 fields will do. Okay, so how do alpha attractors change? Right? Do they change and how do they change? So, okay, what do I call alpha attractors? So again, there's in the literature, alpha attractors are usually referred to things that have sort of a tanh-like potential. For me, alpha attractors are models that live on hyperbolic manifolds, right? So whenever I say alpha attractors, I just mean a multi-field model that lives on a hyperbolic manifold. So my ingredients is a two-field model with some Gij that corresponds to the hyperbolic manifold and some potential. The equations of motion of this are trivial. In a sense, they look like the usual inflation, Klein-Gordon-like equation, but the derivatives with respect to time have to be covariant derivatives with respect to time, and they're covariant with respect to this Gij. So, you take all your GR stuff, and then you can apply it here. This has gamma terms that are gamma computed based on this Gij. And as I said, the curvature is constant and negative, and is inversely proportional to this alpha of the alpha attractors. Now, the isometries of hyperbolic manifolds let us write down this Gij in many ways. Same way as, you can write flat space in polar coordinates or in Cartesian coordinates, right? So here, we can write it in many different ways, and we choose something that's sort of simple to write down, which is the Poincaré disk. So you can see phi and chi are my fields, and the radius goes from 0 to 1, right? Then it blows up. So essentially, the Poincaré disk radius equals 1 corresponds to infinity if you make some other choice of parameterization. So we choose a very simple diagonal metric, and we choose a quadratic potential. So essentially what we want to do is take this and put it on the Poincaré disk. But because we cannot do 100 fields, 2 are hard enough, we start with 2. And it'll turn out that the phenomenology is pretty rich. So we have two masses, there's no specific hierarchy between them, right? And we have a field space manifold. So Anna Chukaro, Andrea Linde, Renata Kalosh wrote a fantastic paper in 2017 where they practically did a very similar thing. They took an alpha attractor model, two fields, and with sort of alpha order 1, so the curvature is order 1, so small curvature. And what they saw, one would assume that if you start here, you will first fall down and then inflate along one of these valleys, right? As you would do in Higgs inflation. Well, this does not happen because hyperbolic space plays tricks on you. As you go back, as you go further up, the angular direction is exponentially stretched, right? So essentially here you are falling down, but you have to transverse a lot of proper distance in order to fall down a lot. So what you end up doing is a slow roll, slow turn motion on the ridge here, on the slope of this hill. And it turns out that, you know, due to some very interesting and to this day sort of a bit ununderstandable interplay between Azure curvature modes and turn rate, the predictions of these models, even if you roll on this ridge, are identical to alpha trackers. So you get the same Starobinsky-like predictions, and sub base 1 minus 2 over n, R12 over alpha squared. Now, the natural question comes, okay, but this is for order 1 field space. Let me crank it up, right? There's no reason why I don't expect strongly curved manifolds, or why I shouldn't see what happens. So this is the, we take the masses to have a ratio of 3, roughly, and alpha to be 1/6, so order 1. Now the diagonal, so the black dotted line is the diagonal, 45 degree angle. This dashed brownish orange line is actually the analytics that come from the Leiden-Stanford group. And the blue is a numerical solution. And this is n equals 60. So we see that they follow each other beautifully, the analytics and the numerics, until the last default, where, of course, Laurel breaks down and you don't know what happens. Now, let me crank up the field space curvature by a factor of 100. Right? So alpha goes from 1 over 6 to 1 over 600. Initially, we start following the Leiden-Stanford attractor. And then what we see is we get pushed up, and we inflate along the angular direction. Right? In this case, n equals 60 happens here. So it does not happen along this sort of almost straight regime. It happens along this very curved regime. So clearly, strong curvature breaks this universality of alpha tractors. Question? No. Okay. Why is that? What the hell's going on here? And by the way, the red line here is our analytical estimate. So we are able to capture this fantastically well. Again, until the last e-fold where Slorold breaks down. So the easiest way to see what happens, and this is sort of historically how we started looking into these models, is we wrote down the equations of motion in polar coordinates, right, r and theta, and we looked at each of the terms one by one, right, for each of the two equations. So let's look at the theta term first. So you see here, we plot the various terms, and we get the 3h theta term, which is the black one, right, the Hubble drag, equals always the potential term. So you see black dotted and red are on top of each other. So theta actually slow rolls. This is the first regime, right, and this is the second regime. First, second. And of course, there's a transient that we cannot capture. That something crazy happens here for a fraction of an e-fold. Now, let's go to radius. During the first stage, again, black and red are the same, right? So this is, again, slow roll. However, after this new regime starts, this angular inflation regime starts, the Hubble drag is here, right? So the Hubble drag is subdominant of the potential. And instead, this Christoffel term, this centrifugal acceleration term, actually balances the potential. So we get a new regime where the radius is almost frozen, right? There's no dynamics in the radius, and the angle slow rolls.
So,
yes, of course.
So this is n, you're plotting respect to n.
This is e-fold, yes. Yes.
So the end of inflation is
here. I start here, and I mean, this is 150 folds of inflation. This is just some parameters I chose to make the graphs look nice.
Where's the start and where's the end?
I start here and I end here. So I start at n equals 0 and I end at n equals 150.
Radius. What's the y-axis is the radius
there? No, sorry. The y-axis is each of these terms.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I'm just comparing the various terms. Right, so here, you know, in the initial stage, these two cancel each other out, right? They're identical. And in the second stage, for the angle, these two still cancel each other out, but for the radius, these two cancel each other out. Right? They have the same magnitude. So this is magnitude of each term in a log plot.
Sorry, then can you go back to previous? Yeah. So the last say 50 equals is just at the very, very end.
Here.
Yes. Or 60.
Oh, this is 60. This is n equals minus 60.
At the end is, oh, no, it's down.
No. Okay, sorry. Yes. I start here. And I do this, and I end, of course. I always end, yeah, I mean the potential has a global minimum. You have to end at zero. Inflation ends here, and then, you know, you have reheating and whatever else. Yeah, but instead of sort of going quasi-straight, you do this crazy excursion in field space.
And these are called like unity.
Yes. A really useful one, yes. Good. So again, we just by doing some simple analytics, we are able to capture exactly how the radius depends on the angle theta. We construct the solution, this red dotted, and the various blue lines, we just started with various initial conditions, the same potential, and we see that in all cases you fall on this attractor. So this is a global dynamical attractor of the system, right? You will end up here no matter what.
It depends on the curvature parameter
exactly.
You've chosen somehow, no?
Yes. And I'll come to that. Yeah, I mean, the number of defaults you spend on this attractor is this. So, you know, we have the full expression, but it's too ugly to put on a slide. But, you know, the lowest order term is the mass ratio over alpha, or the mass ratio times the curvature, right? So bigger curvature and bigger mass ratio, you spend more defaults here. For example, if this n is 1 or 2, you will never see that, right? You need n to be like 10 to say, okay, I have enough defaults on this new attractor to have something interesting happen, right? I mean, if n is 1, I mean, the whole series expansion here breaks down. Right, so how much time do I have? Okay, we can do the analysis of the fluctuations. Now, in this first work that we did, so there are two things you can do. One is fluctuations might be born here on this quasi-single field regime and then evolve through this evolution, or they might actually exit the horizon during this part. For now, we have only focused on fluctuations that exit the horizon here and then check their superhorizon evolution during this new angular regime. So we do the usual thing that I think everyone in this room knows. Define the entropic, so do a adiabatic and entropic decomposition, define the entropic mass, and you see the entropic mass, this is the effective mass of the azure curvature modes, is proportional or has a contribution from the turn rate. So omega essentially tells you how much you deviate from a geodesic motion. So a strong omega means that azure curvature modes are strongly massive, which means they will decay outside the horizon. So in the superhorizon limit, the evolution of isocurvature and adiabatic modes is trivial. The isocurvature modes either grow or decay based on this beta parameter, which is this. So you can see that one very important contribution is this omega squared. So again, large omega, beta is negative, S decays. And the adiabatic modes, what they do is if you have isocurvature modes and you have a turn rate, then essentially, you know, as the trajectory turns, some of the azure curvature modes become adiabatic modes. So let's actually look at all the slow roll parameters so we can actually compute these various quantities.
Is it clear when you change from one trajectory to another, so from the initial one to the circular one, in that fall, those slow roll parameters are valid?
At the exact time of transitioning, no, but this is a fraction of an e-fault. So essentially, there's not enough time to do anything to the power spectrum.
Before, or after?
Before and after, they're perfect, and they're joined by something that's less than an e-fault. And of course, numerically, we check that this doesn't, I mean, we use them transport, and it doesn't make any difference. Thanks. No, thanks for these questions. So this is epsilon. So this is the initial, kind of the old, usual epsilon of alpha attractors, 1 over n squared. And this is the epsilon during this angular regime, right? So epsilon during this angular regime, we have computed it. It goes like the inverse of the number of e-folds in angular inflation, right? So for example, if we have 10 or 20 e-folds of angular inflation, epsilon is something like 0.1. Whereas in alpha attractors, epsilon is 10 to the minus 3. So immediately we have a much larger epsilon. Omega over age is the really cool thing. So omega over h, or omega squared over h squared, goes like epsilon times the field space curvature. But remember that this is the inverse of the space, of the field space curvature. So if you plug in sort of normal numbers, epsilon 0.1 and the field space curvature 10, omega over h is immediately order 1, right? So this model is not slow turn. So omega over h is order 1 and bigger, right? So this is a rapid turn inflationary attractor, which means, you know, everything you learned about kind of slow roll, slow turn is invalid.
In this particular plot, what is R?
R is 25.
So that's relatively and then epsilon is
10 to the minus 1, more or less. So this is like order 1. Yeah, it's not huge. I mean, I can make it huge, but for the values that I care about, if I want to not have very many folds of angular inflation, R has to be order 1. So, you know, order 1 meaning 10, not 10,000. Right. So yeah, thank you very much. I do not need, in order to get something important, I do not need crazy curved field space manifolds. I don't need to tune the curvature, you know, to hell. Right. So superhorizon evolution. This beta parameter is negative, and what you see here is the power spectrum. And once I tuned it at minus 40 e-folds, the angular regime starts. At minus 40, the power spectrum, the evolution of the mode is frozen. So there is superhorizon evolution during the almost single field regime, the traditional regime, but once the angular inflation sets, nothing more evolves, right? Immediately, the isocurvature modes die, so the adiabatic modes get frozen. So you reach the adiabatic limit essentially within an e-fold after you cross the after you transition to hybrid to angular inflation. And this is very interesting. Why? Because this allows you to trivially compute observables. You don't need to do anything else. You just say ns is 1 minus 2 over n, but this n is not the number of e-folds before you cross before the end of inflation. Is the number of e-folds before the end of inflation minus the number of angular inflation e-folds, right? Because essentially there is no evolution during angular inflation, so the power spectrum is set at the end of traditional slow roll, slow turn. And this shows you what happens if you start increasing the amount of n, and what you do is essentially you start crawling away of the Planck regime. Essentially, if you have only 10 or 12 e-folds of angular inflation, you're immediately outside the Planck bound. So this puts a very, very strong constraint, at least in this toy model alpha tractor case, of how strongly curved your manifold can be before you get pushed out of the Planck regime. This is the first time, this is the first way you can actually check, or you can constrain moduli field curvature that I know of. Of course, to be honest, this is what happens as you tune the curvature. To be honest, the curvature is increased even more, then your fluctuations exit during this regime, right? Which means you can still be consistent with Planck, but here you have to somehow fine-tune your parameters to be, you know, essentially, okay, here I increase curvature, so I flow out of the Planck regime, and then I suddenly come back in, right? But I come back in very briefly. Okay, so summary. There's a good thing about alpha tractors in that they're easily and kind of UV-motivated models. They come out of string theory supersymmetry. They give very robust predictions, even in the multifield case, as Achukar et al. Showed. However, there's a new attractor that shifts predictions for CMB observables once the field space curvature is not very small. And we can use that because it allows us to put constraints on the field space curvature of these models in order for them to actually agree with the Planck results. To be a bit more sort of careful here, we constrain the product of the field space curvature times the mass ratio, right? Times the hierarchy of masses of the particles. So this is just a kind of proof of principle of what can happen in these models. If we actually want to make progress, we have to start, I want to start a program of actually looking at more alpha tracker models and more similar models and start trying to putting constraints on the field space curvature depending on the potential shape and the number of fields. Okay, this is one kind of new attractor that we found. However, this is not the only one, right? So before us in 2017, Adam Brown in Stanford found a solution called hyperinflation, which is a very similar thing, but quite different also. Hyperinflation consists of a symmetric potential. So you have two fields in a symmetric ball, right? Just an M squared, 5 squared potential, with a very high field space curvature. And what happens is initially you roll down, and at some point you start spinning around. Sidetracked inflation came after our paper by Sébastien Renaud-Petel and a group in Paris, which initially was thought to be very similar to angular inflation. They also use a negatively curved manifold where they get similar non-geodesic motion with large turn rates. And Anna Chukaro and Ed Copeland also in 2019 wrote down using Hamilton-Jacobi formalism a family of models called shift symmetric orbital inflation, in which you have a constant turn trajectory with vanishing entropy mass. And this can actually mimic single field inflation. So there's a multitude of models, and I bet, you know, if we sit down, we can populate this list very, very quickly. You know, you get two physicists, you get roughly 5 models. Why do I care? Right. So is this relevant to what we're doing here? Actually, it is. Right. There's a beautiful paper by Chukor and Palma in 2019, which thinks about multi-field inflation and the Swamp-Long conjectures. So consider two very simple Swamp-Long conjectures. We had a very nice discussion on the board that was filled with the different conjectures. I'm not an expert, so I'll just take the ones that I know and I can handle, which means the excursion in field space cannot be very large, so delta phi less than delta. Delta is some order one number in Planck units. And also delta V over V, right? So the curvature of the potential cannot be very large, right? Again, C, some order one number. Now, let's assume that you have a highly, highly, highly turned trajectory. Epsilon, the actual slow turn, the actual slow roll parameter, is not just del V over V. It's del V over V times this parameter that has to do with the turn rate. So essentially, if you want epsilon to be small and del V over V to be order one, you just need omega to be very large, right? So you tune up omega, you immediately can have you can have a slow roll inflation in a very, very curved manifold, curved potential. Now let's take the distance conjecture. The distance conjecture, if you kind of connect it with a life bound, tells you that delta, this parameter, has to be of the order of or bigger than epsilon times the number of V-folds. The number of V-folds is typically order 60, so 50, 55, 60. If I combine those two criteria, I get that delta over C, right, those two order one numbers, has to be bigger than this combination of the turn rate and the number of V-folds. Or if I turn it around, in order to satisfy those criteria, omega over H have to be of the order of 3C over delta times N. This means that I can actually satisfy the criteria by choosing n equals 60, c over delta roughly 1. So omega over h has to be something like 180. So you have to have a very, very, very fast turning trajectory, right? And luckily, as I showed at least in this simple model, we can get omega over h to be order 1 if we tune up the curvature to, you know, be 100, then we can actually go to this 180, right? So essentially, you know, this there's a bridge between, obviously, these two programs. All these solutions are not just funny because we didn't know about them. They're not just interesting because mathematically you get rich behavior. They're also very physically relevant because they can actually give us a hint of how to not evade the Swamp-Long conjectures, but how to think of inflation in a more realistic context, especially when it comes to curved manifolds. So one problem with this, right, is that, again, there are already 4 families of models. And as I said, I bet we can write down more. Now, Fermi has been said to have said, if I could remember all these particles, I'd be a botanist. I have Googled that. I don't know if that's an exact phrase that Fermi said, but I will use it nonetheless. If I could remember all these inflation models, I would be a botanist. So can we actually organize the chaos into very simple sort of basic families? So what do we want when we write an inflation model? We want inflation to occur, obviously, right? So epsilon less than 1. We want inflation to be prolonged, right? So epsilon cannot change very much, so eta is less than 1, right? So we want these two things, nothing more. If we have multiple fields, epsilon is just a half VI VI, where VI is just the velocity, the rate of change of the field with respect to n, right? This is just an inner product. And eta is simply the inner product of the velocity times the acceleration. So there are two things, right? For single field inflation, you want epsilon to be small, so V has to be small, and eta to be small, so A has to be small. However, for multi-field inflation, this thing completely changes, right? In order for epsilon to be small, you don't need both the green and the brown term to be small. All you need is for them to be perpendicular, right? So what you need is the velocity to be perpendicular to the acceleration. That smells like turning solutions, right? That's just angular motion. So if I write down a general two-field system, right, phi and chi, and I want to study what are the conditions that I have an evolving inflaton phi and an approximately constant moduli field chi. So I write down all my equations with all the various Christoffel symbols. In order to get a constant chi, I get rid of all the chi dot terms, right? So the equation of motion for chi becomes an algebraic equation, right? And the equation of motion for phi becomes a slow-roll equation. So actually, what happens is that I do slow-roll on the trajectory that actually minimizes this energy, the Hamiltonian. This means that I can define what's called an effective potential of chi, right? And if I minimize this, then I have found my new trajectories. And these new trajectories can be either turning or non-turning. So let's see some examples, and then I can actually have some time for discussion. So sidetracked inflation is, angular inflation is obviously the simplest thing I said in the beginning. Sidetracked inflation has a very similar story to angular in some sense. It has a hyperbolic manifold, right? And, you know, we use the simplest model we can write down, two quadratic fields and a quadratic derivative coupling. Nothing fancy. And we look at how the trajectory at chi equals zero evolves. So essentially, the trajectory at chi equals zero, when the curvature, the field space curvature, is smaller than this ratio of the masses, is always unstable, right? So you always get destabilized and pushed to some new attractor. However, if I choose L almost equal to this ratio, then actually higher order effects come into the game, and I can have a trajectory that is stable or unstable depending on the value of phi. So I can actually define an effective potential for chi, and this is what happens. For small values of phi, we get this red curve. We have only one minimum, so there's one stable trajectory. For large values of phi, we get this. We get 3 zero crossings, 2 minima, and a maximum. So we get 2 stable trajectories and 1 unstable trajectory. So if I plot what happens in the actual evolution of the system, at large values of phi, I have these 2 trajectories. At small values of phi, they both merge into 1. So this is a textbook case of Pittsburgh bifurcation, right? Hyperinflation, as I said, is the first model of this broad family that came to existence in 2017. Initially, it was thought that it was of a completely different nature than everything else. However, the nice thing or the annoying thing with hyperbolic manifolds is you can rewrite them in many different ways. Right? So initially, hyperinflation was written in such a way. So this is the manifold or the metric that was used, and this is the potential. However, I can always do a transformation, right? I can do a transformation from this type of the metric to this. Those are both field space manifolds that are hyperbolic. And if I do this transformation, this symmetric potential becomes a sort of weird potential, right? However, it's weird, but it reminds us of sidetracked, right? It's quadratic with a phi dependence, so it's very much similar to this. I can also do the effective potential calculation. What I see is exactly the same, although on the opposite side. Here, for large values of phi, I get one solution, right, this red line. For small values of phi, I get three solutions. So what happens is that as I flow down phi, at some point this gets destabilized and pushed into one of these two new attractors. Again, the exact same piecewise bifurcation idea. And if I go to the original coordinates, right, this rho coordinates, what happens is that we also get a piecewise bifurcation, but in the angular velocity. So the angular velocity is zero, and then it becomes non-zero with a plus or minus sign, randomly, you know, depending on fluctuations and so on. How much time do I have? Okay, a few minutes. So, again, this, so I showed you that there's a very simple way to construct and analyze these solutions by defining an effective potential and minimizing it. So essentially, I knock down a dynamical problem to an algebraic problem. Here, you can also see why negatively curved field space metrics are important, because essentially you can go away from the minimum of the potential, but G phi phi can actually reduce this Hamiltonian away from the minimum of V. So negatively curved manifolds help you create those solutions. That's why most of them are found in negatively curved manifolds. And one way to actually study them analytically or semi-analytically is using scaling solutions. So scaling solutions have the following property. Epsilon is constant, and all higher order derivatives of epsilon are zero. Right. So why do we care? I mean, why is that relevant? So slow roll motion is just a deformation of De Sitter, right? De Sitter means H is constant and epsilon is zero, and slow roll is just a deformation of this. Now, scaling solutions is a one-parameter generalization of De Sitter. Instead of epsilon zero, we have epsilon constant. And actual inflationary models can be thought of as a deformation of scaling solutions. And we can write down the most general metric we can with an isometry, with a transitively acting isometry. And then we can look for solutions, right? We can look for scaling solutions that are along or perpendicular to the killing vectors of this manifold, right? So we are actually looking for solutions in a purely geometric way, right, along and perpendicular the killing directions. If we, you know, I don't want to bore you with math, but actually we were able to rediscover, in a sense, and categorize. If you actually take a potential with a conserved symmetry, so an angular symmetry, in the case of a hybrid inflation, you actually get hyperinflation, and just look at this. This is for an exact scaling solution, epsilon. So epsilon is 3L times P over 2 plus LP. L is the sort of curvature of the potential, and P is the curvature, L is the curvature of the field space, P is the curvature of the potential. Where do I have it? Here. I don't have it. Okay, P is V prime over V. And the reason I care about scaling solutions is because a real solution, as you see here, is really captured by a scaling solution. So the colored lines, the red and the blue lines, are actual numerical solutions, and the dashed lines are actually the scaling solutions. So you see that we actually can use scaling solutions to capture approximately the behavior of real systems. And that can be applied to both inflation and, for example, dark energy. Sidetracked inflation, you can exactly look for solutions along and perpendicular to the killing vectors. And in sidetracked inflation, epsilon has exactly the same form, 3PL over 2 plus PL. This is the first time we actually realized that those two models are actually the same. You see that you get the same bifurcation analysis that I showed you before. A very interesting feature is that in all the bifurcations that we saw, the system chooses to minimize epsilon, right? It chooses the trajectory, so the stable trajectory is the trajectory that has the smallest epsilon. Again, we can deform the potential, and scaling solutions are still a very good approximation to the actual dynamics. So, okay, summary. Curved manifolds, first of all, appear generically in string theory and these sort of constructions, and naturally allow for non-gradient flow motion. In simple classes, like the angular inflation class, they lead to bounds on the curvature of moduli spaces. For steep potentials, you can actually inflate perpendicular to the gradient of the potential, which means you evade the Swampland conjectures, right? I have not checked if you evade all of them, but at least you know it gives you a way to construct viable inflationary models in steep potentials. And you can actually categorize all the zoo of models that have been out in the literature just by looking at their bifurcations, right? So if you have a dynamical bifurcation, you have hyperinflation or sidetracked inflation. If you have only one stable attractor, you have angular. And if you have infinitely many attractors, you have orbital. Great. Thank you very much.
Yes. So can you get the same predictions of the first part if the curvature, I mean the negative curvature is below 3? Like up to, like really order 1 and not 20?
The same predictions of the first, yeah, what's, like, the, what's, mean, what's the first part?
I mean, the, so you were getting these turning trajectories.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some negatively curved in space. And you had some examples in which I remember it was 25. I was wondering if it's enough to have smaller one, like
sure.
below
yes.
3.
Actually,
that's
it is.
Too small.
No. I mean, in order to get something. Okay, where do I have it? Right. So. Actually, it is because you can also start seeing interesting phenomena in this case, at least in this toy model with just two simple quadratic fields, if you have order one curvature, but you increase the mass ratio, right? So you can swap one for the other.
Okay.
I mean, generically, I mean, okay. Sorry?
So you would need a mass ratio.
100. Instead of 20, like 20 and 10, you would need 3 and like 70. I mean, sorry, that mass ratio squared. So a mass ratio of 10, so mass ratio squared of 100. But of course, you know, all these features are really amplified as the curvature gets stronger, right? For mildly curved manifolds, your potential must sort of make up for the lack of high curvature. Yes.
So presumably, the way you evade the Swampland here is in the presence of curvature. You can have a large radial distance. What do I mean? Well, sorry.
Angular, a long
trajectory in the angular direction at a small radial distance.
Exactly.
Which is, so you're hiding a large distance in a sense, yes. at a small radius.
I mean, one thing is, these were not designed to evade the Swampland conjecture. I mean, these are not some, you know, it just happened that you can get inflation on steep potentials. They're not contrived to solve that, but it just, and I don't even want to claim that we evade them. What I want to claim is that this is a very natural way of getting inflation. So when we have to be a bit more careful when we say that slower inflation is sort of negated because you cannot get shallow potentials. Steep potentials can perfectly give you slower inflation.
So I guess the be interested to know whether people think that's, immune to the, is that genuinely evades the Swampland. I mean, the way naively it's talked about, I tend to think of how, as was being said, when was it the other day, the Tower of States changes with the radial distance traveled. So if it's only a function of the radial distance, you're safe. Do we expect that? So is that a good resolution, or should we be worried about the dependence of the Tower of States, say, on the angular, the large angular systems?
No,
I think it's fair to say that the Swampland conjectures that you're quoting,
I think
they are typically derived in the context of.
Yes, exactly. I completely agree.
Moduli spaces that are not hyperbolic. So So I don't think this has been right.
Well, there are many things, but you can get large terms with flat.
Yeah. Oh yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
So flat model space metric, you can have huge terms as well.
It's true that you are evading the distance conjecture because the tower of states is going to be sensitive to the geodesic distance. So, I mean, that sense is better to go around. I was asking also about the curvature because, in fact, when you go to these like these large field distance regimes in string theory, linked to the fact that you have the tower of states, you also have a negative curvature in field space.
Right.
So, I mean, it's true that both things come together, but it's not a very large.
If you remember, that was my question in the first discussion.
Thing is that now what one should check is precisely what you said about the mass hierarchy. Because what happens also is that in these regimes in which the tower of states become important, also all the mass hierarchies disappear. Mm-hmm. So now it's a matter of numbers. So in principle, it's a good idea like to try to go turning, but it's very difficult, in this regime, trying to engineer this mass hierarchy. So now it's a matter of what is the shape of the potential, right?
It's not that you are going infinite distance. At most, you have
no.
10 tenor planks.
That doesn't matter. It's fine.
And this one will be non-geodesic tenor plank.
That's fine, I'm talking about large field, but still, you are in this regime where the curvature is negative. I mean, I'm not saying go to the infinite, of course. I mean, I'm saying it's finite. Yeah.
But you can also have zero curvatures.
So. Yeah, I mean, these models are sort of, all of them, I would consider them just toy models of what can be done if you start adding a few more ingredients like field space curvature that sort of generically, in many cases, pushes you to this new non-geodesic motion. Nothing has been like, we have not actually started thinking what you said about the interplay or the competition between the curvature and the mass hierarchy. I mean, this starts being a numbers game, and you actually, this is actually very interesting, and it has to do with some specific realization, maybe some specific potential. So this is actually a very nice thing to check, if you can actually be in a regime where you can do something interesting without having to push one of the two to extreme values.
You are talking about the mass hierarchy of your two fields with respect to each other.
Yes.
It's a different way to do it.
For example, the mass hierarchy and the curvature, this simple formula only works for this sort of simple alpha tractor idea, right? It's not a generic thing. But in general, in other cases, in all cases, you would have of sidetracked inflation or this bifurcation type inflation, you will have this interplay of curvature and the angular gradient. So the ratio of the masses is another way of saying what is the curvature of the potential, right? So the hierarchy of masses gives you the angular variation of your potential. You can swap one for the other. It's the same thing with some order one parameters multiplying.
I'm thinking about this model by Pabang, the metric is flat.
Oh, yeah. Sure, but they have a pretty ugly potential.
Yeah, that's super ugly. It's just what you can do.
I do. Sure.
So the more fields you have, they add all together, and omega over H will get.
An interesting thing is also, first of all, yes, if you actually have a potential that actually has a model where the potential is actually built to be sort of a corkscrew, yes. But the interesting thing, at least for me, is that you can have the easiest thing you can write down, like quadratic potentials, and still get interesting dynamics, right, without putting it by hand. I mean, if I put a corkscrew potential, I will get my field going like this, right?
You can have quadratic and have a flat metric and still get high terms.
I agree. Like shift symmetric orbital can do it, yes. One interesting thing that has not been thought about, actually we have thought about it over coffee, but we have not sat down and done it, is what happens in the large N regime, right? If you have large N meaning a large number of fields, right? So that is actually, if you have 100 fields, and then how does the mass hierarchy come into the game, and what happens, and so on.
But each contributes to a time, a real time, so you would.
Yeah, so probably omega goes like root n or something like that.
You may not meet so high
carbon. Yes.
I agree.
The idea is hopefully you might be able to get away, you know, to enhance your turn rate by some root n factor, n is the number of fields, so get away with order one curvature, but many fields. And then the question is the mask hierarchy between those fields important or not? So there are still, I mean, this is scratching the surface. It's really, you know, 2 year old work.
But in principle, you can then have completely flat and quadratic potential and have the turning trajectory as long as you have enough fields, or
there has to be an interaction. So if you have a flat metric in polar coordinates and then a quadratic potential, there's an interaction.
Right? Flat metric in polar.
So you write polar.
So the curvature is zero, or is
the curvature is zero.
Zero.
And then I write my metric in polar coordinates. Okay. And then the potential is just quadratic, and this gives you can have.
Without the mass hierarchy or with the mass hierarchy?
The masses can be close to each other, but so what you need, they don't have to. One apparently is heavy.
I guess you need a bigger mass hierarchy.
Yeah, you need a field that looks, the parameter is large, but then you have to compare with H. So the mass compared to H to the Hopper field.
No, I mean, here the mass hierarchy is the mass, as you said, the mass with themselves.
Yeah.
I did not say that one is heavier than Hubble or lighter than Hubble. Both can be light compared to Hubble, but one has to be heavy with respect to the other. That's the important thing.
Yeah, there's always one heavier, but you don't need a huge hierarchy. And you really need to compare with
that. But is correct the understanding or the intuition that the bigger the curvature, then the less mass hierarchy I need? Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a globally correct intuition. It's actually, I can make a conjecture that this is correct. in certain models, definitely this is what we found, but there's no universal proof. It would be actually good to, all the groups that worked on that actually wrote some specific model down and looked at its predictions. I think, you know, our work on this effective potential idea and the scaling solutions is just to distance ourselves a bit from actually writing down a potential and being able to say some more global things about, you know, features of the field space, features of the potential, and actually start going along the lines that you're thinking about, you know, what sort of hierarchies do we need in both of those terms to get something interesting. Yes?
In this negatively curved manifold type of models you are discussing, I would at least naively expect tachyonic instabilities in the field modes up to a given cutoff scale as well as the curvature. You have that under control? Yeah.
Well, essentially, that's what happens here. That's what pushes you. So, you are on one of the trajectories, let's say along chi equals zero in this case. And then you get some tachyonic instability because you have a negative field space-induced effective mass that destabilizes your motion. You get pushed to this new attractor where omega is large, so your effective mass is actually positive there.
Sure, but you are talking about the homogeneous mode. Now I'm asking about what happens with the modes.
In this new attractor, all modes are stable until inflation ends. During reheating, then, of course, you get tachyonic instabilities again. During inflation, you're fine.
Okay, so you do have that under control.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe just I think to understand the sensitivity to initial conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But those four models, are they all have stable attractors?
Yes.
How sensitive are they to the initial conditions?
This is completely insensitive to initial conditions. This is also relatively insensitive because if you give it some velocities, they will redshift away, and then you will always end up in this attractor. Sidetracked inflation is also, I mean, they've written several sub-models of this class, and I would say that here they have not studied very detailedly how you end up on the attractor. They assumed you end up on the attractor and then you follow it, right? And there is a there's interesting things to be done here also numerically. I think there is one paper that tries to do some lattice simulations of essentially using what Danny said, all the tachyonic instabilities that will push you to this new attractor and the time scales at which they happen. But, you know, there's more work to be done here. And shift symmetric orbital, also, there's not that much work done. Essentially, the one model that was written here was a bit, the potential was a bit ugly. It had the minus one over R term, so a kind of Coulomb-like term. It wasn't the you know, nicest model you can write down. So yes, this is also under work to A, find a model with a nicer potential, and B, once you find that, check whether or not initial conditions matter or not. In general, those attractors are pretty, I mean, the ones that have been found and have been worked out, like Angular and Hyper, they're pretty strong. In a sense, you will flow to them necessarily. It's hard to evade them.
Is there any UV constraint on the sign of the curvature of the internal space? So is it natural to have negative curvature?
I would say yes. As far as I understand, it is natural to have negative curvature. Now, I'm not an expert on how high you can crank it up to be. That is actually the question I want to bug people that are sitting here to tell me how large negative curvatures you can have. But definitely you can easily have negative curvatures, yes.
Okay, so it's natural. And in your case, you are looking at around alpha around 0.01 as an additional point. In this case, curvature scales are 10 to 16 GeV.
Yes.
So curvature is not so big.
Right.
And you said if you consider smaller alpha, it can easily exploit a successful single field inflation.
Larger alpha, smaller curvature.
Large curvature, smaller alpha.
Yes.
So if you consider gut scale curvature, it can easily exploit success of single field inflation, for example.
I mean, both of them, okay, it depends on what you mean by single field. Let me go to this model. I mean, in a sense, both are single field, right? I mean, this is also single, I mean, in a sense, single field. There is a one attractor, but it's large churn rate. What do you mean single, do you call this single field?
Starobinsky, I suppose, isn't it? Is that right? So
yeah, I mean, this is Starobinsky-like.
And you pretend, yeah. And you do potentially mess that up if you have the instability.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, this is also, I would call it single clock inflation, not single field.
It's...
So, sorry, are you asking?
So my question was that if you have some gut-scaled curvature, probably it can easily have some discrepancy between theory and observation.
Yes.
So it means
it's
difficult to have large field inflation generically.
Okay, let me just say this. I'm not claiming that all alpha tractor models suffer from this. Right. For example, the E and the T model, which are like the kind of the workhorses of the theory, they do not exhibit this. They do not exhibit this new regime because the potential is too sharp for this to be able to exist. Right. So not all models suffer or show this, right? So this regime is there; it's generically there, but you can still evade it. You don't have to have it. So saying that all models will sort of suffer from this and it's impossible to not have it is not a fair argument.
Do you have some intuition like how much tuning of the potential is required?
I cannot say this. This is still one of the things we're investigating, which also related to the questions of what hierarchy, essentially the relation of the strength of the potential, sorry, of the strength of the curvature to the hierarchy in the potential. Those are like the two fundamental things and how they're related to each other. We have examples where we know what's happening, but we don't have a global argument of sort of a recipe for doing one or the other.
Thank you.